You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West. The most haunted city in the country. Well, it's quite an interesting situation in the world today. The coronavirus epidemic is running wild. So, in the meantime, take your mind off that by listening to some of the interesting things that we're going to be talking about. Sit back, relax. I've got a new book that came out today. It's a young adult mystery. It's called the Young Writers Series, R-I-D-E-R-S. And it's the first one is Chasing Via's Gold. It's about four teenagers who find a buried treasure and save the day. Well, yesterday we were talking about some of the mysteries of Mars, and we've got some more information about that for today. You know, it was the Viking probes, which were far more detailed and complex than any of the previous investigations into Mars, that led to the discovery of the famous face on Mars. NASA researcher Tony Owen studied the pictures of the Cydonia region, and he was astonished to see what looked exactly like a pair of eyes looking back at him. Closer examination, he saw not only eyes, but an entire face in the photos taken at the plain of Cydonia. There were two eyes, a nose, a mouth, clearly visible and obviously intentionally delineated. Now, there were further investigations conducted by Vincent DiPietro and Gregory Molinar. These began in 1979 when they discovered a second NASA photograph of the face. They also found evidence of eyeballs and teeth and hair. On comparing the geology, the meteorology, and other factors of the Cydonia region, they couldn't find a natural explanation for the face. In fact, the harder they looked at Cydonia, the more they discovered other anomalous photos. 10 miles southwest of the location of the face, they found another mountain, this one shaped like a pyramid, but with five triangular sides running straight from the base of the object to the top at the point. And each side had a V-shaped formation at the bottom, which appeared to be some sort of supporting system for the entire structure. And unlike the results of normal weather erosion, the most worn areas were at the base, not in the middle sections as they should have been. Errol Toron, who'd worked as a cartographer for the U.S. Armed Forces and was highly skilled in the analysis of photos taken by satellites, went to work to examine the pyramid-shaped mountain. And he found that there was no known natural mechanism to account for the DNM pyramid's formation. Even more surprisingly, a mathematical analysis of the shape of the object showed that it appeared to have been constructed in accordance with the principles of geometry. And as he said, the chances of such an apparently artificial structure also happening to exemplify geometrical tenets by pure chance was unbelievably remote. Well, Richard C. Hoagland picked up Torrance's findings, and Hoagland had already made something of a name for himself in context of the evidence for intelligent life on the moon. And contemplating the possibility of proof of life on Mars with some excitement, Hoagland compared the Martian monuments with similar ones on Earth. He realized about 2 miles west-southwest of the face there were a number of apparently artificial formations that looked very much like the nucleus of a city. And they were ordered in geometrical shapes and clustered around a central region rather like a city center. And as he was quick to point out, the central focus of the square would enable a profile view of the face. He also confirmed DiPietro and Molinar's findings that one of the sides of the pyramid is directed straight at the face. Well, struck by all the rapidly accumulating evidence, he described the monument as the Martian Sphinx and suggested, like so many scientists do, that if they don't understand it, it had to have been the focus of religious activity. Well, it's not at all inappropriate, in fact, to refer to the face as a sphinx. In fact, the details of the monument remind us irresistibly of Egyptian pictures, in particular the long sideburn-type section of the face that looks uncannily similar to the sort of headdresses worn by the pharaohs. You know, Hoagland and other scientific colleagues of his discovered that each planet appears to possess a curious energy vortex that occurs at exactly the same map reference in each case, 19.5 degrees latitude. The Cydonia region of Mars, the red spot on Jupiter, and Avebury and Somerset are all in the same degree of latitude. Later researches by an independent team of scientists and mathematicians showed beyond doubt the extraordinary correlation between Avebury and Cydonia. Dead Martians supervised the building of Avebury in Britain. Is that why Britain was thought of in the ancient world as a sacred land? David Percy took this data and formulated a controversial theory on the basis of it. He believes the Martians used some kind of spinning saucer technology that enabled them to create an artificial atmosphere on their planet. Now, Hoagland's research is somewhat compelling. Percy's theory is speculation. Now, many attempts have been made to debunk the anomalous structures found on Mars, particularly the face. It's been explained away by NASA as a purely natural feature, and the various other examples of unequivocal evidence of life on the planet are, according to NASA, simply misinterpretations of data. But in spite of these denials, the Cydonia monuments represent some of the strongest evidence in favor of life existing on Mars. You know, the year 1996 saw one of the most exciting and explosive discoveries by NASA scientists. That year, researchers at the Johnson Space Center cut open a meteorite from Mars that had landed in Antarctica in 1984. And inside, they found fossils dating back at least 3.5 million years. They may be even earlier, as the rock in which they were embedded was dated 4.5 billion years ago. The interesting fact is that NASA was forced by these latest anomalous finds to at least consider the possibility of life on Mars at some period in the past. And as usual, there are a cluster of people anxious to deny facts that conflict with their fixed opinions, but that matter was resolved decisively in 2009 when more advanced and sophisticated testing methods demonstrated conclusively that the meteorite did indeed contain genuine fossils that came from the planet Mars. Now, in regard to the face, NASA was willing to lie to try to cover up its existence. They said another review of Cydonia showed that it was just a result of, the face was just a result of shadows. When in actuality, there had not been another satellite pass over the region. But what's a lie or two when NASA has to carry out its instructions from the Department of Defense to classify anything that would tend to show the existence of life on other planets? You know, in July of 2011, there was more evidence for the existence of life on Mars discovered. It's been established the red rocks on the planet are heavily coated with iron oxide, and we know from conditions on Earth that life can and does flourish in exactly these circumstances. Researchers by NASA and SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, have produced sufficient and controversial evidence to persuade the space agency that the case for at least the past existence of life on Mars is no longer a speculative theory, but an established fact. In 2012, NASA's Curiosity rover discovered pebbles on Mars and the existence in the past of a flowing stream. Curiosity discovered hundreds of the stones, and from the evidence that sent back to Earth, scientists estimate the stream was probably waist deep. The pebbles have been dated to about 2 million years B.C. and constitute the strongest evidence in favor of the existence of life on Mars in the past. Now, Curiosity sampled the Martian atmosphere, and analysis of results showed the planet was formerly much warmer and wetter, with a strong possibility of liquid water having existed on the surface of the planet. And this environment, of course, would have created a favorable situation for life as we know it. On the other hand, Curiosity detected only small amounts of methane, which led the scientists to conclude, although there may have been life on Mars in the past, it no longer exists. And the NASA MAVEN mission will investigate the causes of the depletion of the Martian atmosphere. Now, in an unrelated development, French scientists have discovered a new virus, which they named the Pandora virus. It's 10 times larger than any virus previously known, and only 6% of its genes are similar to earthly viruses. French researchers have concluded the virus may have originated on Mars and somehow arrived on Earth. Once more, the body of evidence in favor of life on Mars in ancient times continues to grow. We know that Mars once had the capability of supporting life. In an earlier stage in its development, the red planet actually presented more favorable conditions for life than Earth. It's entirely possible that as the environment of the planet changed, Martians came to Earth in search of a new home in which to settle. Now, Mars is much further from the sun than the Earth is, and therefore it would have cooled down earlier than our planet. And perhaps as our own world became too cold for them, the Martians sent out a fleet of spaceships to colonize the Earth. They may have founded Atlantis and Mu or Lemuria, or built the vast terrestrial monuments of the Sphinx and the pyramids and Stonehenge. Human civilization might have been created by Martians, and we ourselves might not even be natives of Earth. We don't know, and we'll probably never know, but the evidence is there, and it is strong. One day when we land men on Mars, we will find the faces of our own ancestors staring back at us. Interestingly enough, though, as I said earlier, yesterday when I was in England, I was shown a video of what reported to be a landing of a on Mars in 1963. The Alternative 3 scenario says that it was a crash project using alien technology that we'd reverse engineered in order to try to create a haven to allow some of civilization to survive what the RAND Corporation thought was an end-of-the-world scenario. Now, we've already seen that the evidence in favor of the past existence of life on the Moon and Mars is overwhelming, and even the possibility of continuing life there is now, at least, certainly an open question. So how about the other planets in our own solar system? Could any of them support life? Now, after the Mars and the Moon, the most favorable candidate for possible life within the solar system is the planet Venus. It has a much closer proximity to the sun, which has always made doubters consider that unlikely, but results are emerging from the Venus Express satellite data that is changing the previous perspective on the planet. Once regarded as a flaming mass of poisonous gas, it now appears the planet may actually be more similar to our own than was previously believed. And I would point out a number of the purported contactees have talked about the fact that the aliens they dealt with actually came from the planet Venus. Now, the evidence from the Express satellite suggests strongly that this gaseous planet was, and maybe still is, full of fresh liquid water. Now, Venus wasn't always a world of storms and gas clouds. The Express satellite discovered large quantities of oxygen and hydrogen and in the exact chemical proportions on which water is formed on Earth. And like water on our planet, the water on Venus would evaporate into a gaseous form if ultraviolet light from the sun struck it. So as a result of the data collected by this satellite, it's now thought not only did Venus once have an Earth-like atmosphere, but possibly oceans of water. The water on Venus would certainly have supported life as we know it, which made the conditions ideal for the development of carbon-based forms of life, just like we find on Earth. More evidence in support of life on Venus was found when scientists in 2004 analyzed data and found the clouds on the planet could harbor life. Now, we know that life on Earth can exist inside clouds, and there's no inherent reason why the same shouldn't be equally true of Venus. Latest researches have shown that at one time, Venus presented a more favorable environment for life than does the Earth, and that the changes in temperature and atmospheric pressure would have been gradual enough for life to have found ways of adapting or perhaps migrating to other planets such as Earth. Further support for the idea of possible life on Venus came to light in 2007. As scientists examined the data being fed back to Earth by the satellite, they realized that until a billion years ago, the climatic environmental conditions on both planets were almost identical. Then Venus was hit by a greenhouse effect that made the surface temperature of the planet almost inconceivably hot, bombarding the planet with solar radiation and ultraviolet light. And even though the process was gradual and may have given time and opportunities for Venusians to adapt to the changing conditions, it's also possible they might have left and moved to our own relatively near planet. Professor David Grinspoon has gone so far as to state there's some reason to believe Venus may have been the best haven for life in the early solar system. July of 2008, two scientists claimed that life from Venus could have come to Earth, blown to our planet by strong winds. It only take weeks, or perhaps even days, for microbial life to reach the Earth from Venus. The most recent discovery has been that Venus possesses an ozone layer high up in the clouds above the surface. Until this latest evidence, only Earth and Mars had atmospheres where ozone had been detected. Now that the Venus Express satellites found further evidence of the possibility of life on that planet, scientists are becoming excited about the future prospects. When or if we land on Venus, what might we find? Perhaps the ruins of a civilization that predates ours? Well, another potential candidate was Mercury, the nearest planet to the sun in our solar system, and by all accounts, it's a world of extremes. One side faces the sun, where the temperature reaches 700 degrees Kelvin, while parts of the planet that never experience sunlight are as cold as deep space. On the face of it, Mercury is a thoroughly uninviting environment, but curiously, it has all the conditions scientists regard as essential for making life on other planets possible. Mercury, believe it or not, has oxygen, water, and methane, all necessary conditions for life. On the other hand, the oxygen levels are low, the temperature variations are extreme, no present sign of liquid water, rather than simply water in the atmosphere is ice, and the methane is thought to come from volcanic activity rather than as a result of metabolic waste processes. And although the daytime surface temperature is fierce, studio's falling apart. It's possible there might be life within the solar system of the planet, within the polar regions of the planet, rather. Mercury has a magnetic field that protects it from solar storms and cosmic rays, as well as a large surface gravity that also holds out the promise of life. And in 2009, NASA made perhaps the most surprising of all its discoveries about Mercury. They discovered the planet had water. And even though it remains an extreme environment with fierce contrasts of heat and cold, the presence of water and oxygen in the atmosphere means the chances of life on that planet is higher than anybody ever expected. Well, the next planet that's been examined for the possibility of life is Jupiter, the largest planet in the solar system. It's often been ignored when the possibility of life has been considered. Its atmosphere is said to largely be made up of ammonia and methane, and it's believe the planet also contains a layer of ice 17,000 miles thick. Then in 1961, astronomer Carl Sagan suggested that the huge cloud cover on Jupiter could protect and even nurture life on that planet. Sagan carried out experiments in the lab, creating a simulated Jupiter, recreating its atmosphere before bombarding it with ultraviolet rays. He found the ultraviolet light entering the atmosphere led to the production of simple organic molecules, and that the penetration of the sun rays onto the surface of the planet caused infrared radiation. The heat created by this process was trapped with the cloud cover and formed oceans of ammonia, or, you know, frankly, water. The molecules dissolved into the oceans, and Sagan remarked that the chemical process created would create the conditions necessary for complex prebiological organic reactions. He also considered that the crust of Jupiter might not be the icy wilderness generally believed, and its temperature might be moderate enough to allow similar evolutionary development to the kind found on Earth. Well, Jupiter 10 was the first Jupiter probe in 1976. Pioneer 10. Sagan speculated again on possible life on the planet after the results of the Jupiter probe came in. 1979, he and Edwin Saltpeter produced a paper on the subject. They speculated there might be abundant biota in the atmosphere and also three different types of marine animals in the ocean. The presumption was that they might breathe helium, which was very abundant on the planet, and many organisms might be huge in size. In recent years, attention has shifted from Jupiter itself to its surrounding moons, particularly Europa and Ganymede, both of which are considered to be strong candidates for harboring life. From 1995, NASA space probes monitoring the whole region of Jupiter and the data they transmitted to Earth led to a growing view among scientists that life on the moons of Jupiter is now not only simply possible, but very probable. By 2009, the information received led one scientist to declare, "I'd be shocked if no life existed on Europa." It's felt the most probable form of life to inhabit Europa would be some kind of marine animal. Not only is there a vast ocean on that moon, but there's sufficient oxygen on the satellite to support a large population. Then we have the ringed planet Saturn. It's felt to be one of the least promising candidates for life within our solar system. Its environment is one where it's said that there are fierce winds, high pressure, strong gravitational pull, and extreme temperatures. Principally, they're in the sub-zero region, although in parts of the planet it's 80 degrees. The atmosphere contains ammonia and water, so there's the possibility of life, particularly some kind of marine animal, but overall it's still considered quite a hostile place. Saturn's moons, Titan and Euclides, much more promising candidates for life. 2011, scientists speculated both satellites might actually harbor life, particularly Titan. Both planets have liquid water, and Enceladus has hot springs that erupt from the volcanoes on the otherwise frozen surface. NASA probe Cassini found exceptionally warm temperatures in the southern polar region of that moon. There's also strong evidence of a saltwater ocean in the presence of carbon, methane, ammonia, and nitrogen. Now, Titan is thought to be an even more promising candidate for life than Enceladus. It has abundant lakes and hard to crop, and is considered extremely similar in its chemical state to Earth in its earlier days. Another Saturn's moons, Hyperion, has hard to carbons that have been detected. Now, while prospect for life on Saturn itself remains slim in the view of scientists, the chances that it might well exist on at least one and maybe three of its satellites is now very strong. Now, what would be interesting would be find out that they are actually more advanced than we are. Certainly, they would be older. Now, Uranus is considered one of the least likely candidates for life within the solar system. Planet's surface is principally made up of ammonia, methane, water, and the solid part of its surface is ice. The atmosphere is said to overwhelmingly be composed of hydrogen. The temperature on the planet's exceptionally cold, and although there are warmer places within it, the atmospheric pressures are tremendously powerful and make it hard for life to survive. And without sufficient sunlight to provide power or any evidence of volcanic activity will generate heat, it would be difficult for life as we know it to survive there. Now, on the other hand, given the high percentage of water on the planet, it is possible marine life might be able to exist. And the warmer parts of Uranus might be even more promising than presently believed, and gas clouds that surround the planet may also have given birth to avian life forms. At best, it's considered a long shot, but it's not impossible that life exists on that planet. Well, let's look at the planet Neptune, which is further out in space than Uranus. But water is abundant there. It also has large gas clouds, so as with the planet Uranus, the possibility of marine or avian life can't be dismissed out of hand. I mean, let's face it, life flourishes on some of the most inhospitable environments on this planet, and it seems equally possible it may also do so on the remoter planets in the solar system. For the moment, though, only the presence of abundant water makes it a faint possibility, but it remains one of the least likely places to harbor life. It'd be my guess if it's advanced life, it's probably underground. Well, Pluto, which was a planet for a number of decades, now has had its status degraded from that of a full planet to an asteroid. But it has three attendant moons, Charon, which is the best known. And it seems surprising that an asteroid would have moons. Again, the hypothetical prospects for life aren't considered good, particularly in terms of the fierce cold that pervades the planetoid. On the other hand, the Hubble Space Telescope has shown it has gravitational pull upon it from its satellites, which creates friction and could have turned some of that frozen water ice into liquid water. So it does have the basic elements for life to arise. That is life as we know it. But life doesn't have to be identical to what we have here on Earth. Other forms of life can be just as advanced. Now, NASA's also discovered that the surface of Pluto, while cold by Earth standards, is nowhere near as cold as was previously believed. Methane has also been found on the planet, as well as water in the clouds and ice. It's even been discovered that it has a relatively weak greenhouse effect, so heat is building up under the cloud cover. All in all, taken together with the data from friction, Pluto is now perhaps a stronger candidate for life than it has been considered in the past. But it does raise a number of questions. Now, having demoted Pluto from the status of a planet to an asteroid, the International Astronomical Union has chose to upgrade Ceres from asteroid to that of a dwarf planet. And the prospects of life on Ceres are considered to be surprisingly good. It's believed to have oceans, a more attractive atmosphere than Pluto, and in general to be the most likely of all the outer fringe bodies within the solar system to harbor life as we know it. But again, you have to wonder. Now, there have been a number of hypothetical planets that have been suggested to have existed within the solar system. The best known and the most plausible is called Vulcan, most famous as the home of Mr. Spock in Star Trek. But originally it was proposed to explain the irregularities in the orbit of Mercury by the French astronomer Lavoisier, co-discoverer of Neptune in the 19th century. And there were a number of sightings of a body between Mercury and the Sun that were identified as the planet Vulcan. Now, later researchers were able to explain the anomalies without the need for the existence of a planet between Mercury and Venus. The idea of Vulcan as a real planet is now generally dismissed, although a minority of astronomers continue to think that some celestial body may exist in the general area where Lavoisier placed it. Generally, the view is that such worlds would be asteroids rather than full-blown planets, but it's not impossible that undetected planets can exist in that area. Other hypothetical planets within the solar system lack the benefit of a great scientific mind like Lavoisier to buttress their claims. Truman Bethurum, on the basis of his dubious contact claims, declared the planet Clarion existed on the dark side of the moon. And, of course, Howard Menninger declared he had visited this non-existent planet. Now, Howard Menninger, or Menger, I guess, M-E-N-G-E-R, was a house painter who became the ambassador from the planet Clarion. And he had quite a well-developed cosmology he used to put forth. I read a number of his works. He wrote several books. Now, in recent times, particularly by people who've been interested in the Mayan calendar. It's been suggested a hypothetical body known as Planet X or Eris or Hercolubus, Sedna, Tyche, Nemesis, the comet Elenin or Nibiru exists as a 10th planet within our solar system. Zachariah Sitchin, in his translation of the Sumerian tablets, wrote at great length about the planet Nibiru. Now, this world is dangerous and will eventually cause another cosmic catastrophe that will lead to the end of the life on Earth, at least according to a number of scenarios. The name Nibiru, that has come to be the most common name for the hypothetical planet, was used originally by Zachariah Sitchin. Comes from ancient Mesopotamian mythology, and Sitchin insisted it had no connection with any kind of cosmic calamity. What it's worth, he regarded it as being the 12th planet of the solar system, not the 10th. According to Sitchin, Nibiru, also known as Marduk, passes Earth every 3,600 years. And during its passage, the planet's inhabitants visit Earth and teach humanity their higher wisdom. Sitchin identified these astronauts, I guess you could say, as being the same as the Anunnaki mentioned in Sumerian mythology, and claimed they were the origin of religion on Earth, humans having wrongly identified the terrestrials as extraterrestrials as gods. 1995, Nancy Leader claimed that she'd been told by contacts from Zeta Reticuli that Planet X, as she called it, would collide with Earth sometime in the early part of the 21st century. Well, we're there. Her ideas spread slowly until in 2001 they attracted notice of a wider audience when a book about them was published. Leader said that the Planet X was about four times as large as Earth, and that when its perigee occurred, May 27, 2003, Earth would stop rotating for 6 days, and this would cause a massive polar shift and a displacement of the Earth's crust. Well, that didn't happen. And she immediately said her statement had been deliberate disinformation to mislead the authorities, who she said are planning to use the arrival of Planet X as an excuse for worldwide repression. You have to kind of wonder. 1996, she identified Planet X with Sitchin's Nibiru and agreed with him it was the 12th planet in the solar system. Sitchin, of course, repudiated everything she had to say. The original idea for Planet X came from discrepancies that astronomers in the 19th century believed existed in the orbits of Uranus and Neptune. Percival Lowell, the man who launched the idea of Martian canals, thought the orbits of the two planets weren't as they should be and put forth the theory that both were affected by the gravitational pull of another planet, which he called Planet X. Other astronomers searched for this planet for over a century, but there was no evidence that it existed. The Sumerian tablets make it very clear, though, that there is another planet out there, and it's in a long elliptical orbit that takes it out into deep space and brings it back close to the sun. Now, the idea of the sun itself might be an inhabited world is a very ancient one. Well, as many myths and legends of sun gods, writers have explored the idea for 2,000 years. And a number of distinguished scientists regard it as at least theoretically possible. 1795, the astronomer known as Herschel claimed it was highly probable life did exist on the sun. He believed it was simply a large planet with a solid surface and an atmosphere that would make the existence of life possible. Other astronomers agreed with him. In as late as 1860s, many supporters of the idea of life on the sun continued to press the case for its existence. Then, as always happens, opinions began to change, and the whole idea was dismissed as impossible, largely because of the fierce temperature on the planet. 1951, a German engineer put forward the theory that sunspots were holes that led to the interior of the sun. In his opinion, it was possible life might exist in the heart of the sun, and he made a very public bet that scientists would be able to prove that life didn't exist on the sun, but a German court ruled against him and forced him to pay the German Astronomische Gesellschaft the money he'd wagered. Later, scientists began to revise their opinion on this subject. First place, two of them have estimated that in about 5 billion years' time, the sun will become a red giant and the Earth will become part of a huge gas cloud as a result. However, the Earth will survive inside the sun's nuclear furnace, and eventually the sun will expel it. And beneath the surface of the planet, microbial forms of life that are heat resistant will be able to survive. Other scientists, though, have gone further, claiming that life on other planets might be fundamentally different from life on Earth, and it might be possible for organisms to live inside the sun. The idea of plasma-based life forms has attracted particular attention from scientists. You know, given the present level of technology and the current unwillingness of governments to deploy significant funding for space research, it's likely to be a considerable time before we're in a position to acquire the data to evaluate the chances of life on worlds outside our solar system. Now, there are a number of solar systems considered as possible candidates, but at present, there's simply not enough evidence on which to make an informed judgment. Now, SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and SETI, C-E-T-I, Communication with Extraterrestrial Intelligence, are projects that have been in and out of fashion since the 19th century. Greater technological development since those days has dramatically improved both the methods of detecting intelligent life in the universe and the prospect of being able to communicate with it in the event it's discovered. You know, the 20th century saw a surprisingly large number of signals from space picked up by radio receivers that appeared to show evidence of order and intention. Particularly promising in terms of apparent evidence for extraterrestrial contacts, what is known as long-delayed echoes. The study of these LDEs and a particular remark made about them and by Professor Ronald Bracewell led to a breakthrough in SETI. In 1973, Duncan Lunan, a Scottish astronomer, declared he had succeeded in decoding a long-delayed echo received at Eindhoven in Holland in 1920. He claimed the signals were actually charts of constellation of stars and would plausibly be interpreted as signifying the messages implied their transmissions came from these constellations. He found that there were striking similarities to Bootis, Epsilon Bootis, and Arcturus, also known as Alpha Bootis. Lunan also discovered Arcturus was in the position it would have occupied about 11,000 B.C. Now, Bracewell, of course, was delighted by Lunan's claims, regarding him as the best evidence yet for successful communication between Earth and other worlds. But a number of other people were less than thrilled by the idea. Apart from the inevitable accusations that Lunan had distorted his data to get the results he was seeking, there was also the suggestion that plasma clouds in space could have been responsible for slowing down the signal. And although serious criticism have been made of both Lunan's methodology and conclusions, they haven't been disproven. In fact, the present balance of evidence is slightly in favor of his theory being correct. And if, in fact, his theory is correct, that is the strongest evidence yet for life in outer space. Now, anomalous radio signals have also been detected by the Radio Institute at Gorky in the Soviet Union. They were detected in 1973, the same year that Lunan claimed to have decoded the Eindhoven long-delayed echoes. Both the Soviet astrophysicists who detected them were unequivocal in their belief they originated from outer space. One of them, Dr. Nikolai Kordashev, said that we've been receiving radio signals from other outer space in bursts lasting for anywhere from 2 to 10 minutes. Their character, their consistent pattern, and their regular transmission leave us in no doubt they're of artificial origin. They're not natural signals, but have been transmitted by civilized beings with sophisticated transmission equipment. Dr. Vsevolod Trotsky also stated there are definitely call signs for an extraterrestrial civilization. However, as from time to time happened under the former communist regime, exciting and challenging claims were soon backpedaled rather rapidly. Trotsky later suggested it might be the result of solar activity. And other Soviet scientists immediately blamed an American spy satellite orbiting in space. When in doubt, in Russia, blame the CIA. The truth would probably never be known, but it does remain a fascinating mystery. Radio communication remains one of the most likely methods to produce clear proof of extraterrestrial life. You know, nobody really knows what the Russians detected that year in 1973, but the wisdom of caution where anomalous signals from space is concerned was shown by a fiasco involving pulsars. In 1965, similar periodic emissions were found in a radio source. At once, astronomers began to suggest that an extraterrestrial civilization was attempting to make contact. In 1967, a star that transmits radio frequencies at regular intervals was discovered. Its discoverers, being facetious, named it LGM, which stood for Little Green Men. Further analysis and observations led to the discovery of two new and entirely unexpected natural phenomena. The 1965 signals came from what we now call a quasar. The 67 ones came from what we now know as a pulsar. The astronomers who had jumped too quickly to an extraterrestrial explanation looked a bit foolish as a result of the discovery. Now, Carl Sagan, who devoted a considerable portion of his career to the investigation of both SETI and SETI, believed that though the radio transmissions may be a useful method of trying to communicate with intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, more promising method might be using laser technology now available. In his view, lasers offer optimal improvement and will be entirely suitable for interstellar contact. Anthony Lawton offered the idea that lasers already suggest that CETI transmissions have been beamed at Earth in recent years. He pointed out that lasers could be used to create anomalies in the solar spectrum, adding that 15 stars have been discovered through its use, all within 100 light years of Earth, that possessed anomalous spectral radiation. Now, he did admit that all were probably caused by purely natural phenomena. However, if any of these spectral anomalies had been deliberately engineered, that would and could only mean intelligent extraterrestrial life. Now, lasers haven't yet proved or given us any unequivocal proof of directed origin from outer space, but they are a major tool being used in SETI research. Well, in 1960, a professor by the name of Frank Drake of Cornell University began an ongoing project involving radio monitoring stars. His objective was to see if the radio signals coming from them were artificial in origin. The two stars so chosen for his study were Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani, both about 11 light years away from Earth. He called his project Ozma, implying it was about as likely to succeed as the journey to find the wonderful Wizard of Oz. The only thing that made it perfect would be if the lead scientist's last name was Toto. In spite of his pessimism about the project's success, he tuned his 85-foot dish to Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani for a period of 6 months. He chose to keep it tuned into the 21-centimeter waveband, the frequency which radiation is emitted by hydrogen atoms. Almost as soon as the project began, he and his team got the shock of their lives. They detected an obviously artificial signal from Epsilon Eridani. No apparent source for the signal, other than a transmission from the star, could be found at first. Now, Drake was a very cautious individual, so he didn't make a premature announcement of a successful SETI experiment. After a few weeks of careful investigation, he discovered that the true source of the signals was radar equipment from military aircraft. Well, his caution saved his project from the ridicule that a false claim would have caused. 1971, he became involved in an altogether more extensive program known as Project Cyclops. This made use of a massive observatory with a series of radio telescopes having a 10-mile diameter. Cyclops was designed to listen in to literally millions of transmissions from stars as far away as several hundred light years. Cyclops program, unfortunately, would have been so expensive to institute, maintain, and never progress beyond the drawing board. but it does remain one of the great enduring monuments to the human imagination. Well, there have been a number of questions asked. Most importantly, if life exists, how common is it? Harlow Shapley, using a highly conservative model, came up with a figure of a minimum number of about 10,000 million inhabited worlds. Drake, working on a more optimistic projection, estimated over 100,000 million planets capable of supporting life in our galaxy alone. If either figure is even approximately correct, in spite of the technical difficulties that still persist, we could look forward to the eventual successful discovery and communication with an extraterrestrial civilization. Now, Stephen Hawking wasn't that enthusiastic about the prospects of active search for extraterrestrial intelligence. In other words, he wasn't in favor of the deliberate transmission from Earth to other stars in order to alert them to our existence. His view was it posed considerable danger and warned scientists against pursuing the project any further. He said, if aliens ever visit us, I think the outcome would be just like it was when Columbus first landed in America, which didn't turn out very well for the Native Americans. Well, in 2010, SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, celebrated its 50th anniversary with a conference. One or two delegates shared Hawking's concern. Others pointed out that there were already enough radio and television transmissions into space that weren't even directed consciously toward contact with extraterrestrials. And the active SETI, they didn't believe, posed any additional risk. Of course, Hawking did have a point. The same point that the Robertson panel made in the 1950s when they were asked to weigh in on the communication with UFOs. Every time a more advanced civilization comes in contact with a less advanced civilization, eventually the less advanced civilization has collapsed. If we are wind up in contact with an extraterrestrial civilization, we could well be that less advanced civilization. That would not be good for the home team, to be perfectly frank. Well, one of the most promising attempts to detect alien life came about as a result of the space program. April 8, 1966, saw the launch into space of the world's first orbital astronomical observatory. Unfortunately, after only 2 days, it had a power failure and went out of action. 2 years after that, in 1968, the Orbital Astronomical Observatory 2 was launched. It failed to achieve a stable orbit in space. The Copernicus satellite, launched in 1972, also failed to live up to the high hopes that had been placed on it. A sufficiently large orbiting space telescope could, at least in theory, detect and transmit back to Earth any evidence of anomalous and possible extraterrestrial phenomena. However, the unwillingness of governments to fund such programs has made it extremely difficult for SETI researchers to arrive at any positive conclusion. The space shuttle and the space station Mir showed that placing sophisticated hardware into space really does result in a more accurate record of the universe. Now, in 1994, there was a major breakthrough in SETI research. Alexander Wolzjan of Pennsylvania State University discovered three new planets outside the solar system orbiting a sun. Unfortunately, the sun they were orbiting was a dead star, a pulsar. In 1995, there was a more promising discovery. Two astronomers in Switzerland discovered that 51 Pegasi, a star extremely similar to our own sun, had a planet circling it. But the distance of the planet from the sun was so close, they doubted if any life could flourish with the intense heat to which the planet would be exposed. And later that year, the most dramatic of these new planetary discoveries was made. Godfrey Marcy and Paul Butler at San Francisco State University located two planets well outside the solar system. They were observed in orbit around the stars 47 Ursae Majoris and 70 Virginis. This time the stars gave the appearance of being alive, and the planets were at a sufficient distance from the sun for the presence of water and rain to be possible. The temperature was also more similar to our own world than those of the other planets that had been discovered. Although somewhat hotter than Earth, it wouldn't be sufficiently so as to inhibit the possibility of life. And on the communication side, a number of ambitious projects were set up in the 70s. The Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft were launched from Kennedy Space Center in Florida in 1977. And inside each craft was a selection of items designed to demonstrate to any discoverers there is intelligent life on Earth. It included maps and charts and photographs of our planet and solar system, DNA structure on our planet, cultural achievements, sporting activities, and the life cycle of humans from conception to death. And the craft had the capability of transmitting information back to Earth as they went on their journey through space. Then in 1992, we saw the beginning of NASA's high-resolution microwave survey be the most ambitious SETI monitoring exercise ever mounted. 1,000 stars that have been scanned by the most powerful telescopes in the world and tens of millions of radio frequencies will have been investigated. Well, in the brief time it was allowed to function, the high-resolution microwave survey was an outstanding success. And then, sadly, those geniuses in Congress passed a bill that specifically forbid NASA to search for signs of extraterrestrial life. The passing of this measure by Congress was one of the darkest days in 20th century history. Seth Shostak of the California SETI Institute compared it to allowing Columbus to build and equip his ships and telling him he wouldn't be allowed to go sailing. Fortunately, the generosity of private individuals and companies resulted in a scaled-down version of the high-resolution microwave survey. The SETI Institute and other private institutions gave generous funding to what became known as Project Phoenix, although it was on a far smaller scale than the initial. It was also able to continue with targeted searching for signs of extraterrestrial life. And one of the most recent and unusual attempts to communicate with extraterrestrials is a project created by Doug Vaycock of the SETI Institute in collaboration with composer Andrew Kaiser of Carnegie Mellon University. The two men have written music they hope might be sent out into outer space to identify aspects of human culture. The music they compose is similar to previous musical attempts at communication with the universe, such as the first Theremin Concert for Aliens and the Voyager Golden Record, both of them previously released to the infinite expanses of deep space. Hell, if you wanted to send all rap music into space, I could get a collection up to pay for that. As well as the use of radio signals and lasers, other approaches have been suggested for communication. Most such as the use of gravity waves or neutrinos are simply too costly to be practical. On the other hand, there are still some methods that might pay dividends and wouldn't be prohibitively expensive. How about attempting to detect stars that showed excessive infrared emissions, which might be a sign of waste heat generated by some kind of mechanical process? Certainly that's got the possibility of success. Then there's been the proposal to search for stars that have spectral lines that have been created by compounds that don't occur naturally. One theory was chlorofluorocarbons as an example of something that never occurred in nature and that created strong spectral lines even in small quantities. It'd be relatively easy for such tests to be carried out. And the assumption that there is something more interesting to be found now that you're going to be spending a lot of time looking at that spot in the sky, as identified by the chlorofluorocarbons, would certainly add another dimension. You know, one of the key questions that remained unanswered is how typical a model is our own solar system with a central sun around which planets orbit. Computer simulation from the University of Washington attempted to show the process of planetary formation. Its results found that planets are formed around a young star and they develop regular orbits. In the early 21st century, one of the principal focuses of astronomers has been the search for planets orbiting other stars. And over 100 such worlds have been found to date. Now, the majority of those discovered so far have been huge gas giants, similar in size and chemical composition to Jupiter, but with continuing improvements in technology, smaller planets are expected to be found that might have higher prospects for discovering life. Before the 1960s, the majority of scientists were broadly hostile to the idea of life on other planets. And even though the mood shifted with the development of the space program and a gradual realization of the improbability of such a vast Aries universe possessing only a single inhabited world, the continuing failure of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence to produce any tangible result led to a return to the earlier skeptical approach toward the idea. And SETI research became known as a science without a subject. Well, it wasn't until the 1990s that the scientific community slowly began to change its mind about SETI. And from the 1980s on, the majority scientific opinion shifted once more, and consensus became that life on other planets, however remote, was virtually certain. Among biologists, there's considerable confusion as to how they might be able to fit in the existence of life on other planets with the prevailing ideas about DNA. Stephen Gould is quite willing to entertain the possibility. He argues that it's more probable to believe in the uniqueness of Earth and in the general diffusion of life throughout the universe. For a long time, the biologist Richard Dawkins adopted that same attitude. He argued that the likelihood of the DNA code arising in more than one place by chance is so remote there could not possibly be life on other planets. Although he finally abandoned that position, it continued to govern the underlying assumption of his later theory on alien life. Jacques Monod, a poet among the neo-Darwinians, wrote that before life did appear, its chances of doing so were almost non-existent. The universe wasn't pregnant with life, nor the biosphere with man. Our number went up on the Monte Carlo game. It's surprising that just like the person that just made a million at the casino, we should feel strange and a little unreal. Apart from the fact that this is simply a series of personal opinions rather than a scientific statement, it also begs the question, how likely is it that there is life on other planets? You know, certainly there are unique characteristics here, and it's not to say that life on other planets must mimic life on Earth at the same time. There are certain pre-existing assumptions that a lot of people seem to take comfort in, one of which is that it's not going to be tentacled creatures that come off that landing spacecraft. It's going to be something with two arms and two legs and a head. That may not be the case. Well, we've come to the end of another show. I'll be back tomorrow night when we'll talk more about UFOs and aliens and life on other planets. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.